Good afternoon, and once again, welcome. This lesson is being recorded for Sunday, May the 10th, 2026. This is the lesson that will be presented at 6 p.m. when we gather together here at the Rose Avenue Church of Christ. And as is always the case, if you are in our area, we invite you to come and be with us as we gather throughout the week to worship God and to study His Word. Every Sunday we have a Bible study at 9:45 in the morning, a morning worship service at 10:50, an evening worship service at 6 o'clock, and then we have another Bible study on Wednesday night at 7:30. And you're welcome to come be with us every time that we gather together. It is our hope that God is glorified by the efforts that we put forth, that we are seeking to worship Him following His instructions, because it's about Him, and listening to what He has to say by devoting time to a study of His Word. These lessons that I am presenting here, preparing ahead of time, are reminders to us of what it means to serve God. And it is my hope that in everything that we do, God is certainly being glorified in these things. So let's go ahead and get started with the lesson that we have prepared here for today. This is the second Sunday of the month, and therefore it is a continuation of a theme I started several years ago, our journey through the Bible, which is a study of the 17 time periods of Bible history. And as I've been in this for about 4 years now, and I still have probably 6 years or more to go, Lord willing, to get through this entire study here. And of course, like I said, this is about God's plan of salvation unfolding as it is recorded within Scripture. And we're currently in the ninth of the 17 time periods of Bible history. The first period is the events leading up to the flood or the creation and all that. Then you have the flood and the events that are associated with this. Genesis chapter 11, you have the scattering of the nations at the Tower of Babel. Following that, you have the period of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, as well as Joseph and others. Following this, you have Israel while they are in Egypt. This is followed by the Exodus, as well as the wilderness wanderings, tying those two things together. That is followed by conquering the land of Canaan and dividing the land. That is followed by the period of the judges, a period of around 400 years. And of course, that leads to the United Kingdom, which is where we are currently at. A period of about 120 years where you have three kings over Israel, and Israel is as a rule united together. There's obviously some challenges a little bit during this for a short period of time, but basically Israel's one nation during the period of Kings Saul, David, and Solomon. And it was a period of expansion where Israel was concerned, and so on. Recorded in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel, as well as 1 and 2 Kings, or 1 2 Samuel and 1 Kings, the first part of that. And this is the United Kingdom here. And then, of course, you have 1 Chronicles, which chronicles the life of David as king, as well as 2 Chronicles through chapter 9, which takes you through Solomon. So that's this period of history. And there's a lot of other books, poetic literature, most of the Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. Those are all during this period of time. And that takes place. Now, We are in our sixth lesson dealing with the United Kingdom, and today we're going to conclude the life of Saul. And you may recall in our last lesson we addressed how Saul is pursuing David. You know, he's been rejected as king in 1 Samuel chapter 15 because he didn't obey God. And he knows that David is the one who has been anointed to take his place. And so Saul determines that he's going to destroy David. He wants to kill David. And of course he fails miserably, because you're not going to stop God from his plans. Twice, and this is what we talked about in the last one, David has this chance to kill Saul in the wilderness, and he doesn't do it. He leaves it in God's hands to take care of. And as we concluded that lesson, we find that Saul has gone home, And David has gone his way with the men who are with him in the wilderness. And we're going to find, as we begin with our lesson today in chapter 27, that David actually goes to the land of the Philistines. He goes to a city of Gath, and that's where we want to begin in 1 Samuel and chapter 27. And what you find in this particular text, as I said, he goes to Gath, where he finds a king who is named Achish, and basically he somewhat allies himself with Achish and the Philistines, at least for a time being. It lasts about 16 months is about how long he is there. Now, an interesting observation in verse number 4 of chapter 17, you read there, chapter 27, you read there that when Saul hears that he has gone to the land of Philistines, he stops pursuing him. And that's basically the end of Saul pursuing David. He's not about to go into the land of the Philistines and try to engage them in their property to get David. So we find David is there. He starts off in where Achish is in Gath, but then he requests a city where he and his men can dwell, and he's given the city of Ziklag, and he dwells there, as I said, for about a year and 4 months, as it is described. Achish believes that David is totally loyal to him during this time. As a matter of fact, he believes that David has actually defected from Israel and is fighting against Israel. And as a matter of fact, what we actually read is happening is David and this group of men, valiant soldiers, and I'm going to touch on that a little later, but they're valiant men. And what they're doing is they go to the southern border of Israel and they begin attacking cities and nations that are enemies of Israel. And primarily enemies of the tribal area of Judah. You might say the state of Judah if you're breaking up Israel into the various tribes and so on. And so he's actually attacking enemies of Israel. But Achish thinks that he's actually fighting against Israel. As a matter of fact, Achish asks him, "Where'd you go this time?" And David actually lies to him and says, "Oh yeah, I've been fighting in the southern part of Israel." I guess that was around about true is in the southern part, but it wasn't against Israel. And he mentions a couple of other places where he goes, and those were men based on the genealogies that were related to Judah and so on. And Achish is so confident in David that he actually makes his troops a part of his army. And that's what you find in chapter 27. But that brings us to chapter 28. And what we find in this chapter is Saul's downward spiral continues. He doesn't know what to do, and now Israel is being attacked again by the Philistines, and he doesn't know how to respond with a battle. Matter of fact, he seeks counsel from Yahweh, and he hears nothing. Matter of fact, it specifically mentions in the text there that he hears nothing in dreams, in the Urim and the Thummim, or from the prophets. God is not responding to him. I just describe that as the deafening silence of God. And it's because of his rebellion. So what Saul does is he goes to a medium, a witch, as described in some translations, in Endor. Because he wants to speak to Samuel. And of course, it's already been emphasized. And you may remember in our last lesson, Samuel had died. But he wants to speak to Samuel again because the Lord won't speak to him. And it's interesting when he goes to this witch, and the witch makes the observation, or this medium makes the observation I can't really do this because Saul has cast out all the soothsayers and the mediums from the land of Israel. So if I do this, I am in danger. And of course, Saul says, "No, you're not in danger." And by the way, she doesn't know this is Saul yet. But nevertheless, she does what is requested of her. And we find that Samuel actually appears. And the way it's described, and this is worthy of note here, the way it is described is she is actually very startled when she sees Samuel. And then she knows that not only has Samuel appeared, but she knows that she's speaking to Saul. And what's so significant about that is that kind of tells me that as a witch, and I don't know everything about her, as a medium, this was different because this was the real thing. And that kind of makes you wonder what she had done prior to this. Was it actually smoke and mirrors? Was it deceit? Was it not real? I don't know all the answers to that, but here Samuel actually appears. And the way you read it in the text, this is something that literally happens because Saul carries on a conversation with Samuel on this occasion. And Samuel rebukes Saul for disturbing him, which I find is an interesting thing. You know, I was at peace. Why are you bringing me back from that to this place? But nevertheless, Saul says, because God won't answer me. And of course, Samuel's response is, of course he won't answer you. You've been disobedient and rebellious against him. And yet you want him to answer you. But nevertheless, Samuel tells Saul that this day tomorrow, you're going to be fighting the Philistines and you're all going to die. And of course, when Saul hears this, it says he falls on the ground. He's absolutely devastated and stuff. And so those who are with Saul, as well as this medium, they try to encourage Saul and pick him up. They try to give him food. He doesn't want to eat. But they convince him, you need to eat. You need strength to deal with what you have to deal with. And so Saul finally takes food. And he leaves that particular place here. But bear in mind, he's now been told, tomorrow you're going to die. That's a powerful thing to consider about that. Now that brings us back to the battlefield in 1 Samuel chapter 29. And we read in that text that the Philistines are gathering their army at a place that's called Aphek. And they're preparing to engage Israel at Jezreel. And more than likely what you have here is a valley and the Philistines are on one side and David and his Israel and its troops are on the other side of Jezreel. And they know that war is about to take place. Meanwhile, you have this the Philistines with their thousands and thousands and thousands of soldiers. They're having a military parade is probably the way that I would describe it. And the various garrisons are passing by before all the lords and so on as they're preparing to go to battle. And at the very back, here is David and his troops passing by. And remember, King Achish, he actually thinks that David is loyal to him. But the other lords of the Philistines, they're very concerned about that, and they say, we don't want David going with us to this battle. You just send him back to where he's supposed to go. We don't want anything in this battle. And they remind him, you know, what better way would it be for David to be restored to the favor of Israel than going there and turning against us while he is there? And they even remind him, isn't this the one of whom it said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? So they understand the impact that David has. And they don't want him going with him. And there's military wisdom in that, if you're looking at it from an earthly standpoint. And it's kind of interesting because Achish tells David, you know what, I trust you. I think you're loyal to me. But the other lords, they don't want you to go. So you just have to go home. Thank you, and so on. And it's interesting, somewhat comically in the text, David says, why? What have I done? It's almost as if David acts as if he is offended. But in reality, he's been delivered from a difficult situation. So David and his men, they're sent back home to Ziklag. And in the meantime, the Philistines prepare for battle. Well, that brings us to 1 Samuel chapter 13. So David and his men, they're returning to Ziklag. And what they find out when they get there is the Amalekites have invaded the south. And they've also invaded the city of Ziklag. As a matter of fact, it says that they burned the city to the ground. And they've taken the spoils of the city. And they've taken all the women and the children captive and carried them away. They did not kill them, but they carried them captive. And they led them away. And of course, as a result of this, David's men, when they see what's happened, they're very disheartened and upset, and they're angry with David. This is one of those occasions, David's their leader, and because this happened, they want to stone David to death. I mean, now, they're not going to carry it out. David basically has to assure them of what's happening. And it's interesting because what David does is he calls Abiathar. And you may recall Abiathar is the son of Ahimelech, who was the high priest that Saul had killed at Nob along with the other priests. Ahimelech, his son, more than likely he is now the high priest, and he has the ephod. He has the Urim and the Thummim, which were used to inquire of God. And David asks God through Abiathar, should we pursue the Amalekites? And if so, will we be successful? The Lord answers him. We're not told how, but we're told, go, you will be successful. And so they go. David and his men, they go. 600 soldiers that are with him. And I don't know how far along, but they're on their journey. They come to a river. And about 200 of the 600, they're not able to continue. They're just exhausted. And so basically, the 400 leave them there. And more than likely, they leave some of their equipment with them and stuff like that. So they're able to guard whatever possessions they have, while the 400 soldiers that are left, they go on their way to engage in battle against the Amalekites. So they come to the Amalekites, and as they're headed toward there, they come across this Egyptian in the wilderness who is dying, basically starving to death. And when they talk to him, they find out that he had not eaten or drunk anything for 3 days. And long story short, he was actually a servant of one of the Amalekites, but he got sick. So his servant just left him behind to die. Well, David and his men, they show compassion. They feed him. They give him drink and they strengthen him up. And they basically ask him if he will help them to find the Amalekites. And he agrees to do that. Of course, he says, I'll do it under two conditions. Number one, you spare my life. And number two, you don't turn me over to them. So, and of course, they agree to do that. And as a result of that, this servant, he leads David and his men to the camp of the Amalekites. And when they find the camp of the Amalekites, they find that they're celebrating, they're eating and drinking, and they're dancing in the midst of the people and so on. And you find that as this takes place, that David and those who are with them, they attack the Amalekites all that day. Matter of fact, it's basically until the next day the way that it's described. So you have this battle that lasts for several hours, maybe 24 hours, and so on. And they utterly wipe out the Amalekites with the exception of 400 who escaped on camels. That's all the details that were given as far as that is concerned. But we do find that the spoils were still there. The families were still alive. And so the families are delivered back to the various men who are with David on this occasion. So, as they are returning home to establish themselves, they meet the 200 men who did not go with them, who had stayed behind because they were exhausted and so on. And some of the 400, and they were described as wicked and worthless in the text there, they said, you know what, we'll give them their wives and their children back, but we're keeping all the spoil. They didn't go with us, they don't deserve any of that. But David says, absolutely not. We're going to share with them. And David reminds them that their victory came from Yahweh. We're here because Yahweh was with us. And furthermore, it's described in the text that David actually enacts a law that deals with these things. You don't forget those who are behind, those who are left behind. We provide for them as well. And so that's what you have in the text. And then finally, in the last part of chapter 30, we find several cities throughout Judah are actually mentioned. And David shares some of the spoils with them. And that is very likely an act of gratitude. More than likely during all these years that David has been fleeing from Saul. And the time that he's been spending in Ziklag and going and engaging in in battle against the enemies of Judah in the south, you know, more than likely these various cities have been grateful to David, and they've protected him, and so on and so forth. And also this builds good relationships with them. And so he shares some of the spoils with these various cities, which will become helpful a little later on. But that brings us to the last chapter of 1 Samuel. And this is the battle that takes place. The Philistines engage Israel in battle, and the Philistines are victorious on this occasion. And as a matter of fact, just as Samuel had prophesied to Saul, his three sons, they're named Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, they're killed. And Saul is also mortally wounded. A soldier just draws an arrow and it strikes him. And Saul is dying. And so Saul asks his armor bearer basically to finish him off. Kill me, because if they find me alive, they'll take and torture me, and I don't want to do that. And his armor bearer refuses to kill him. So Saul falls on his own sword, as it is described. So basically, Saul finishes himself off. And then the armor bearer also kills himself, which demonstrates the loyalty that is there. Well, the next day, as the Philistines are pillaging, they find Saul's body and the body of his sons, and they cut off their heads. They take the armor off of them, they strip them of their armor, and they parade it throughout the territories of the Philistines, and they're celebrating. Then the armor is actually taken to the temple of the gods of the Philistines, and the head of Saul is actually nailed to the wall in the temple of Dagon. So that's what we find in our text in 1 Samuel chapters 17 or 27 through 31. But there's something else we need to consider as we talk about this. We also find at the end of this, in verses 11 through 13, the last verses here, that the men of Jabesh-Gilead, they hear about Saul's defeat and his death and what's happened. And it says that they travel all night, and I would say it's into dangerous territory, into the territory of the Philistines, and they find their bodies and they retrieve their bodies, they bring them back to Jabesh, and they burn their bodies. And understand, this is respectful here. This isn't done in a disrespectful way, but respectfully. And then they bury their bones, and there's mourning for 7 days. And we'll come back to Jabesh-Gilead in another lesson later on. And you may recall that Jabesh-Gilead, this was actually the first city that Saul saved after he became king. Remember how there was hesitation? And in 1 Samuel 11, Saul is sparing the men of Jabesh-Gilead. And he saves that particular city. And that's where he is established as king by all of Israel on that particular occasion there. So this is the Jabesh-Gilead repaying Saul. But now, I also want us to just take a few moments and turn over to 1 Chronicles chapter 10. And while you're turning over there, this is a good time for me to introduce the book of 1 Chronicles, as we are now going to find parallel passages between 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, along with the rest of 1 Chronicles and into 2 Chronicles. And basically, you have parallel accounts in some of the areas here. It's like the Synoptic Gospels of the life of Jesus, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And you could tie John into that in some ways. Basically, you have the same occasion that's recorded by different writers. And that's basically what you have in the Chronicles as well as Samuel, and I think the Kings are a continuation after 1 and 2 Samuel. Now, there are some differences. And incidentally, when you've got parallel passages, you need to study them together if you want the complete picture of what is going on with whatever the event is that is described. Now, what's the difference between the Kings and the Chronicles? Well, the books of Kings, and also 2 Samuel in particular, they're dealing with the divided kingdom. And in particular, the Kings deals with the divided kingdom, that is, northern Israel and Judah. and the history of various kings as they are divided, and some other things on bookends of that. Chronicles just focuses on the tribe of Judah. And the emphasis of that is it's focusing on David and his reign. Now, we begin in chapter 10 because the first nine chapters are basically genealogies. And what they're doing is they're establishing the bloodline of Saul, of David, as well as the tribes. The 12 tribes are all dealt with in these various genealogies. And so you have lots and lots of names just establishing who belonged to who. Those types of things. But then we come to 1 Chronicles chapter 10, and we have our first parallel between 1 Samuel 31, the last chapter of 1 Samuel. And if you read the 1 Chronicles 10, you're going to find a lot of similar statements are made. However, there's just a couple of things that are worth noting that are different about 1 Chronicles 10. And one of those is it is in 1 Chronicles 10 where you read that the head of Saul was fastened to a wall in the temple of Dagon. 1 Samuel doesn't say that. Another thing that is interesting is at the end of 1 Chronicles 10 verses 13 and 14, you read about why Saul died. And this is basically a summary of the life of Saul in two verses. It says, Saul died for his unfaithfulness, which he had committed against the Lord, because he did not keep the word of the Lord, and also because he consulted a medium for guidance. But he did not inquire of the Lord, therefore he killed him, and turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse. And that's a summary of the life of Saul, as it's recorded in 1 Chronicles chapter 10. There is one other interesting passage worthy to consider in this, in 1 Chronicles chapter 12. You know, if you wonder about the 600 men who are with David, and again, Chronicles is chronicling various individuals in these things, and it basically, in this chapter, it describes how David's army was growing while he was at Ziklag, and you actually find that in verse number 1 of 1 Chronicles chapter 12. And you have all these various individuals that are mentioned by name. Now, there's some interesting observations that are made here. Among those observations, you have among those who join him are those who were basically of the tribe of Benjamin. And they're described as mighty men. So these were people who defected from Saul's army because of who Saul was, and they come to David. And they're described as mighty men who were very accurate with bows and with slings. So they were able to... You're not just talking the soldiers that were dropouts. You're talking about trained warriors, some of the top warriors. They don't want to serve Saul because of what Saul is, more than likely. You also read throughout this chapter that men from Manasseh, Judah, and Gad, they joined David. And again, many of them are described as the leaders of those people and so on. So understand, this men of 600 that David has, this isn't a thrown together group of soldiers. This is skilled warriors. That's who David has in his midst. So that would explain why David is so successful as he engages in these battles. So there we have the context that we have dealt with today. But as I've done in so many of these lessons here, let's make some applications. Let's consider some lessons. And as you're going to see in this, as with all of these lessons, there's a lot of lessons that you can learn. Number one, talk about how God protects those who belong to Him. You know, this has obviously been a dark time in David's life. He's living in the wilderness. It could not have been comfortable, but yet we find that he's loyal to Yahweh, and Yahweh is loyal to him, and Yahweh is with him, even as he goes into enemy territory. And that's what we read about in this text. I mean, David is living among the Philistines, and he's being protected. God's not done with him. Matter of fact, God's just getting started with David being anointed as the coming king. And I'm reminded of what Paul says in Romans 8 and verse 31. If God, what shall we say then? If God be for us, who can be against us? Understand how he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. 1 John chapter 4 and verse number 4. Another lesson that we can learn from this is how fear can lead to lies. And in this particular case, and you know, we've seen this all throughout the history. But here in this case, you've got David. You know, David is in enemy territory, and I don't know if that's if the Lord told him to go there. Now, the Lord is protecting him and so on, but I don't know if he specifically told him to go there or if he could have protected him in other places. Well, he could have, obviously. But whatever the case, here is David, you know, in Gath, Achish, and then Ziklag and so on. He's preserving himself. And so when Achish asks him, where have you been? He lies to him. I've been fighting against Israel. No, he hadn't. You know, a couple of observations. You know, one, do you put yourself in a situation where you're at a disadvantage with unbelievers? Don't forget 2 Corinthians 6:14. Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. Don't give them the advantage when you don't have to. They already have enough advantage. But the other thing I want to remind you of is don't think for a moment that David lying was something that God approved of. You know, people might look and say, well, David lied. Rahab lied, so it must be okay to lie if it's for a good cause. Don't assume it's okay to lie. Ephesians 4 and in verse number 25. Ephesians 4 and in verse number 25. Paul says in that text, therefore put away lying. Putting away lying, let each one speak truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Revelation 21 and 8, where John describes how the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, sorcerers, murderers, and he goes on, kidnappers, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone. I think we need to take that seriously. We don't need to be thinking in our mind that lying is okay. Another lesson that we can learn from this particular account is the folly of the occult. You know, Saul knew how God felt about mediums and about witches and about soothsayers and other things. Matter of fact, the law outlawed it. Over in Deuteronomy chapter 18 and beginning in verse number 10, you read in that particular text there, it says, there shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son pass through the fire. And I want you to think about that. Making your son pass through the fire. Human sacrifice. There shall not be anyone who pass through the fire, or one who practices witchcraft, or a soothsayer, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer, or one who conjures spells, or mediums, or spiritists, or one who calls up the dead. And that's what a medium is. For all who do these things are an abomination to the Lord, and because of these abominations, the Lord your God drives them out from before you. You shall be blameless before the Lord your God, for these nations which you will dispossess listened to soothsayers and diviners. But as for you, the Lord your God has not appointed you to such. That was the law. And incidentally, Leviticus 20 and verse 27 said that they were to be put to death. Mediums were to be executed. Now, in Galatians chapter 5, 19 and 20, 21, here you have this, among the works of the flesh, you have described in there these types of things. You have described their idolatry, sorcery, hatred, in verse number 20. Revelation chapter 21 and in verse number 8, sorcerers are mentioned among those who will have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone. You may recall in Acts chapter 19, Paul is in Ephesus and many obey the gospel, and 50,000 days' wages worth of magic books were being burned. That tells you what was being preached about that. Remember Simon the sorcerer or Simon the magician in Acts chapter 8 as Philip goes to Samaria? He hears the gospel and he obeys the gospel. It's not okay to continue to do what he was doing before. All of that just emphasizes the folly of the occult. And I see that in this text. I'm reminded of that. But yet Saul is disobedient to God again. And as we noted there in 1 Chronicles 12, this is one of the reasons why Saul died. It's not the only one. But why did he die on that occasion? Not only did he disobey God, he consulted mediums. That's given as a reason. Why did Saul go to a medium? Because he had been rejected by God. And because he had rejected God himself. Saul was desperate for answers. You know, when you turn away from God, who are you going to turn to? That's a point for us to give consideration to. That's where disobedience leads. And that's really a point for us to give consideration to. And that kind of leads to my next observation. This is what I describe as the deafening silence of God. I want you to think about what God's silence meant where Saul was concerned. Saul knew what it meant. God was not with him. And you know, I understand that God doesn't speak and work today the same way that he did back then for a number of different reasons. We still need to understand that if you are out of favor with God because of the way you're living your life, because of your wrong attitude and actions, as I talked about previously in our previous lesson today, how can you expect God to hear you? David would say, or the psalmist would say, Psalm 66:18, if I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear. Same thing that Isaiah says. God's not going to listen to your prayers. Isaiah 59 verse 2, your iniquities have separated you from your God. He's not going to listen to you because you're living in sin, because you refuse to repent, because you're rebellious against him. The silence of God is a deafening thing for those who desire to be right or know what's involved in being right. But another lesson that we can get from this, and this is everything that we've talked about, and we'll see this throughout our studies. God's able to do what he needs to. He can accomplish his will. You know, even in the land of the enemy, in the land of the Philistines, God preserves David. He still has a purpose for David from that standpoint. Another lesson that we can learn from this is God provides a way out for David. And this is an interesting observation here. You know, David is in a circumstance, and what I'm thinking about in particular, as David is, you know, prating before the Philistines, and they're getting ready to go engage in a massive battle against the Israelites, and David has his men with him, and you know they, and I'm sure this isn't really where they wanted to be if you think about it. I mean, are we really going to go fight against our brethren? How are we going to get out of this? Well, they do get out of it. Because the rest of the Philistine army says, we don't want them with us. Whatever the case, it's a difficult circumstance where David is concerned. And the way out is provided for him. And again, I want to emphasize, and I know things are different today, but I think God is able. God is able to accomplish what he needs to accomplish. And I'm reminded of 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13 where Paul there said, no temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with that temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. God's going to give you a way out. It may not be easy, but there is a way out. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 18. The Hebrew writer there says, he himself suffered being tempted. He is able to aid those who are tempted. Jesus suffered. Jesus is able to help us with what we need. Always keep that in mind. Now, don't expect miracles, but God can provide a way. And he does provide a way for us to escape temptations and lusts. Seek God in times of trouble. And what I'm thinking about here, again, you've seen this all throughout the life of David, but here it is. You know, he comes back from the parade to Ziklag, and he finds that the city has been burned, and his wives have been taken. His wives were taken along with the rest of the men. And yet, before he actually goes, he turns to God and asks, "Do we go?" So you find him, even in times of trouble, he's seeking God. And what I think about this is when we're dealing with struggles and troubles in this life, one of the things we need to do is we need to be seeking direction from God, which means we need to be reading God's Word. We may need to be reading up on a specific subject, and there's resources to help you do that. You could also turn to God's people. We're here for one another. You know, confess your trespass to one another. Pray for one another. You know, go to the leaders of a congregation for guidance. That's what they're here for. And so you find that. Another lesson that we can learn from this is don't give up when you're facing troubles. David comes to Ziklag, and while the men are disheartened and so on, and they're upset for a moment, David directs them, and they keep moving forward. They regrouped, and then they did what was necessary. And that's a lesson for you. When you face a setback in this life, when you face troubles or whatever they are, it doesn't matter. Don't give up. Move ahead. Another lesson we learn is compassion for the weary. I think of those 200 men who were exhausted, who were left behind, while the 400 went and engaged in battle. And with God, the 400 was enough. And I think of the Egyptian slave who was left behind to die as they took their resources with them. You see compassion. David showing compassion for those who are vulnerable and those who are weak. As Christians, we too need to be compassionate. 2 Corinthians 1, 3-6 talks about how God is a God of comfort. He comforts those who need comforting, and so that we can comfort those who need comforting. That's a very, very, very loose interpretation of that text, but that's the point. We need to be comforting each other. I mean, think about Jesus. How often in the life of Jesus do you read he had compassion for those who were around him, and he helped them with whatever their needs were. The many of his miracles, that's what it was about. The healings, the casting out demons, the feeding of the multitudes. That was the compassion of Jesus at work. Another lesson we can learn from this is the importance of those who work behind the scenes. You know, those 200 who couldn't go on, like I said, you know, it's very likely that they could have left stuff with them. They could have left things, so they could have just protected the spoil that was left behind and so on. And I'm just reminded of this, the importance of those that work behind the scenes. You know, most good works have a support staff that is behind it. If you ever go and watch a production, a play, or something like that, there's usually individuals behind the scene that you'll never see. You may not know their names, or if their names are mentioned, it's just briefly mentioned and so on. But that event could not go on without those who were behind the scene. And I'm reminded of how we as the church are described as the body of Christ. And I believe 1 Corinthians 12, I think it's talking about a local church. It's talking about the body as a whole, but it's also talking about local congregations. We're a body, and we need to be functioning like a body. And every part, the presentable and the unpresentable parts, have a purpose. Every part has a purpose. Some are more outspoken, you know, some are more out front. Others are just behind the scenes doing what needs to be done. But it's all important if a task is to be accomplished. And that brings to another lesson to consider here, and that is you show your gratitude. David shares the spoils with several cities in Judah. And likely, as I said, from time to time, very likely, these helped David as he was dealing with whatever he was dealing with. We need to be grateful also as we live our lives. How often does the New Testament emphasize our need to show our gratitude? Colossians 3 and verse 15, let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body, and be thankful. 1 Thessalonians 5:18 talks about giving thanks always. We have to be grateful. And we see that demonstrated by David throughout his life. But another lesson, and this is just the overall lesson to consider, is the ultimate downfall of pride. Saul, he never overcame his pride. And here we find the tragic end of the life of Saul and his sons because of Saul's rebellion. Proverbs 16 and verse 18 says, their pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Never forget that. We've talked about that on many occasions. Another lesson as we begin to wrap this up, just two more points here. One is the reality of death. Hebrews 9:27 says, and as it is appointed for men to die once, but after this the judgment. Saul died. It's going to happen. And as we've noted on numerous occasions, it's going to happen to us. If the Lord does not return during our lifetime, 100% guarantee you're going to die. It's bottom line. And we need to prepare to stand before God when that happens. And that brings me to this final point that I just kind of mentioned as I think about this, and that is showing due respect for the dead. You know, here you got the men of Jabesh-Gilead. They hear about Saul, King Saul, and how his body's being paraded and mauled and so on. And out of respect, they actually go to great efforts to retrieve the body of Saul and his sons. And with respect, they bury the bones. You ever wonder why, you know, we have funerals. And as a rule, we're demonstrating respect for somebody that has died. And why do you do that? It's because it demonstrates the value of one human being. And the bottom line is, as Christians, we know the value of a soul. Their soul. Regardless of how they live their life. The fact that it's a human being, it should be treated with respect, not with disgrace, as those who are haters of God and haters of men, the way that they treat bodies. We should not do it that way. You show respect. And it shows their respect for them and for us as well. Respect for the dead. That's a powerful thing to consider. And thus, we can see the history of God's people. And it's filled with lessons for us to learn. And in our text that we've talked about in this lesson here, we find the end of a tragic chapter in Israel's history. But it's also the beginning of a new chapter, a new hope, which is going to be found in David for the next several decades. For 40 years, as David will reign, we find that. And of course, in summary of all of this, life is filled with both good and bad events. You may not be able to control many of them or most of them, but you can control how you react and what you do about it. And in all of this, we must never forget who is ultimately in control. So think about that, and the lesson is yours. And I just simply ask the question, as you look at your life and as you study God's interaction with His people, and as you read about it throughout God's Word, where are you headed? How does God view you? Where do you stand? If you're not right with God, let me encourage you to make yourself right with God. If there's some way that I can give you direction in doing that, let me know. Let me know in the comments, whether on Facebook or YouTube, and I'll do my best to get you an answer. But in the meantime, thank you. And until next week, may God be with you, and may you be with God in everything that you do. Have a good day and a good week. Until next time. Goodbye.